hey, it's Radio Free Nintendo. Can you do a little mush mouth for me, John?
A mush mouth? No, I can't do mush mouth.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways.
It's Radio Free Nintendo, episode 240. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, is John Lindemann.
Right here for you people.
Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And James Jones.
Hi.
Yes, we're here to talk about Nintendo for about 2 hours with you, the listener. We have a fun show for you today, a lot of interesting games coming up in new business, and then after the break, we're returning to your listener mail. We took a little time off last week, got a little carried away with new business and retroactive, and so we didn't have time for mail, so we're going to catch up on some this week, and of course, the letters are mostly about Project Cafe, or whatever you want to call it, the new console, so we'll be getting into some of that fun. James, could you kick us off, please?
For new business? Sure. The game that I've been playing primarily this week, and I mentioned it in passing last week, is Phantom Brave for the Wii. It's a port of a PS2 Nippon Ichi strategy or tactical RPG. I draw a distinction between the two, and that this is more tactics-based than strategy-based.
Is that really a semantic argument, though? I mean,
no, because tactics and strategy are completely different things.
You want me to get John McCain on the phone again? We talked about this during the Ogre Battle.
Do it!
I mean, I know what you mean, but I'm not sure those two words actually mean very different things. But go on.
Well, in this case, there's a pretty noteworthy difference, because the game is entirely based on understanding the various mechanics that are in play within the game's structure and using them on a very micro level.
That's generally how I tend to think of it. It may not be the correct way, but in terms of RPGs anyway, it's like micro level is tactics and macro level is strategy.
Right. Right.
But in this case, it's really, really, really micro level. Like, to the tiniest micron.
In what way?
So, the premise of Phantom Brave is you play this girl named Morona, and she's obviously an orphan because it's a Nippon Ichi game. And in the act of her parents passing away, she somehow gained the ability to interact with the spirits of the dead, colloquially referred to as phantoms. And the ability she has isn't just to see and communicate with them, but she can actually summon them and give them physical form. So she uses this power to make a living working as essentially a bounty hunter. How the game works is you start on an island, and that's sort of your base of operations. There you can purchase items that you can equip to your characters. You can sort of manage the party stats, but you can also do things like upgrade your equipment through the blacksmith, or take two items and merge them together to give the stats of one item to something else, or to give an ability to something else. Mm-hmm. Or you can do that with non-plot-based characters. So you can merge two characters from two different classes into each other, so you have, like, a fighter who can heal.
You put two people in a chamber and one comes out?
Basically two ghosts in a chamber and one comes out,
two ghosts enter, one ghost leaves.
There's something similar to that in Breath of Fire 2.
Yeah, a little bit.
Which is my favorite part of that game, actually.
There is a lot of it in this game. So what you'll create are these sort of hybrid characters. And since you can only summon 13 characters anyway, there's certain reasons to go about doing this. So you take these characters that you've equipped with anything from pensive longsword, because every item has an emotion attached to it.
I look forward to frivolous knuckle duster.
There's stuff in there like that, like lackadaisical hammer. I was like, really?
The most useless kind.
Sometimes really. It works, sometimes it doesn't. It doesn't really care though.
But with these items can level up, and your characters can level up. Your items learn skills that you can unlock through the blacksmith. Your characters learn skills just through generally leveling up. So really, you're hybridizing items and hybridizing characters to then create a character-item hybrid. It's really kind of screwed up. So then you go into battle. But in every battle, the only person on the map is Morona. And what she does is, the battlefield is covered in, and this is the same in all Nippon Ichi games, it's covered in these just random items that are just strewn up across the ground that characters can stand on to get height. They can pick up, they can throw them around, they can use them as weapons if they don't have a weapon equipped. And what Morona can do is she can summon a ghost into one of those items to give them form. And that phantom stays around for a predefined number of turns based on that character's stats.
Can you, for instance, summon a ghost into a dog food bowl?
No, I haven't seen a dog food bowl yet, but I have summoned a ghost into a Victrola. which was just lying around on the middle of a battlefield for no discernible reason. And then after the number of turns expires and the character vanishes, leaving behind both the item that they were possessed into and whatever item they were equipped with, which you can then use to summon characters into both of them. But sometimes they'll actually take the item with them. So now I have a Victrola sitting on my island for no reason. I can use it as a weapon if I wanted to, and it's got weird attacks like loud noises and distracting music.
Now, at some point, dudes hit each other in this
game. Yes, they do eventually. Yeah, okay. So...
because I'm kind of losing you.
When you summon these phantoms, you sick them on whatever your objective is. Usually it's eliminate all enemies or eliminate all enemies of this color. Something along those lines.
But isn't it essentially like a grid-based strategy, or like Final Fantasy Tactics or Tactics Ogre or that kind of thing?
It's a bit closer to the other Nippon Ichi games because there's a lot of just random stuff.
Discoia.
Yeah. And there's another one, I can't remember what its name is right off. But there's no grid, so you can move around as much, you can move them with this analog movement set that lets you go based on what the distance is, not so much based on how many grid spaces you move.
Oh, like Quest 64.
A little bit, yeah. But I don't want to compare anything to Quest 64. It's just not fair.
You've compared several acts of physical suffering to that game.
Well, those fit.
That's fair.
But what's weird or frustrating about the game is that I have a handful of phantoms that are really, really powerful, and I can use them pretty much endlessly, and they would win me every battle. But in the case of a bunch of them, they really only get to stick around for 3 turns or 5 turns, 4 turns, somewhere in that range. And after that turn is done, even if they don't attack in those turns, and you can't control the turn order, they're gone, and you can't bring them back for the rest of the battle.
That's interesting, not being able to control the turn order, because that what you might think...
You can game it a little bit.
...would be part of how you could, you know, overcome the battle. It's like, well, I've got some really powerful characters, I can only use them at a particular time. Mm-hmm. You want to maximize the damage they could do by thinking ahead when they would attack.
Right. So a lot of what you have to do is you have to kind of deal with economizing your characters. So you have to say, all right, I've got 3 enemies back here that I can deal with a relatively small number of unimportant characters. What can I put this character into, and what character can last long enough to take care of all of them? And then I have to move Morona across the map before I bring in the other characters, or they won't make it in time. They'll run out. And I've had a lot of boss battles end because all that was left was Morona. And she's just running for dear life, casting her relatively weak ranged attack that she has because she's carrying around a dead log as her weapon. It worked.
Dead log.
I don't critique the dead log, but eventually she gets cornered and that's the end of that. So the strategy really comes into making sure you use your characters properly, which is always a very difficult experience. It is very easy to level up additional characters because you can replay old battles. But all of their games actually, sort of let you continue to raise the level cap by merging characters. So the max level of a character or an item in this game is 9,999, as if anyone will ever get there. But it's very difficult to level up a character that's already at the level of the rest of the battle, because you can only get to use them for a handful of turns, so you want to try to use your weaker units as much as possible before bringing in the reserves to defend. I enjoy it. It's really complicated, and things will kick in. Like, there are enemies that will try to throw all the items off the screen before you can summon anything into them, to basically make it so you can't win.
Is it a lot of random stuff?
The enemies and the layout of the map is scripted, mm-hmm. But you'll find that the enemies do different things depending on some criterion based entirely within the game that I don't quite get.
Sure.
So if I lose and I go to replay it and I develop a strategy based on dealing with what happened, they could do something totally different and blow me up again.
Well, I guess the interesting thing about Phantom Brave is that there really aren't many games like this on Wii.
I don't know that there are any.
Because on the other systems, especially like on PSP and DS, I think there are a few games kind of in this vein, but
right.
On Wii, is there a version of Disgaea for Wii? I know there's one on DS. So this might actually be one of the only games, but yeah. Are you playing it with the pointer or classic?
I'm playing it with the Classic Pro. I haven't tried the pointer controls yet.
I mean, it seems like that could maybe work for this kind of...
I'm not sure how it would use it.
I guess if it was... you said it was originally a PS2 game, right? So yeah. it wouldn't be designed very much with the pointer in mind.
Yeah,
probably not.
It's very long, so I saw somewhere that this is a guide that covers all 20 chapters. I'm like, oh, I've done about 15 battles. I should be in good shape. No. Chapters are based on series of four battles that are revolve around a story point. I'm like, oh god, the game's already incredibly difficult, and I'm only a quarter of the way in or less.
I'm glad you're playing this game, so we don't have to.
It's enjoyable, but I'll never beat it. It's like,
oh,
this,
you say that now.
Oh, 200 hours later, James.
I have
confidence in you, James.
Look, I never beat this guy, and I got to the last battle because they suddenly jacked up the
Phantom
levels of
Phantom Brave Mystery Dungeon coming up.
No, god, no. Thankfully, though, like I said, most missions are only... Some of them can be done in 10 minutes. So they're really quick, and you can just burn through them until you hit one that requires you go start merging characters and leveling up new ones. And
so there is a fair bit of that preparation goes into the battle. That's where it's more like Ogre Battle, I guess.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, a lot of this micro stuff, maybe not so much, but...
You have to spend Ogre Battle levels of prep time on your characters, even though there's a decidedly smaller number of them. And then you have to spend way more focus and attention on the battles than you do in Ogre Battle.
Yeah, they don't sound like they play themselves to quite the same extent.
No, it's there's a lot of figuring out what's best to work within the means you still have available to you. And sometimes you get really lucky and you pull it off on the first try, and sometimes you totally flounder and blow it entirely. But thankfully, because the battles aren't very long, you know, it's not terrible. It's just, there goes 10 minutes.
And that's Phantom Brave.
Yes. one point to say, though, it has a decidedly upbeat game considering the tone of the story. I mean, it's like, it's got like this really happy soundtrack. But I would say go look up some of the music in this game. You'll probably, not the stuff that sings, though. That's really awful. But otherwise, yeah, it's interesting. Let's put it that way.
Okay, well, John, you have an update on Chrono Trigger for us?
Yeah, Chrono Trigger update.
Previously on Chrono Trigger.
Yes. You know, I've started taking the train to work, so I now have much more time that is with just me and my DS.
It's pretty much how I got through a lot of Chrono Triggers on the train, John.
Yeah.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah, I'm pretty much, my commute is about as long as it can get on Boston public transit. I'm pretty much going from one end all the way to the other. So I have about 2 hours a day of just sitting there. But yeah, so I've finally gotten the Wings of Time.
Oh, dude, yeah, you've made a lot of progress.
Yeah, I've been playing it a lot.
So you're flying now.
Yeah.
Because that music.
Oh, look at you angling for me to put it in again. I know your ways.
Yep. Yeah, so it's the first time I've actually seen the interface where you choose on the little clock.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. The weird thing about playing through this on the DS is that I don't really have anything else to compare it to. Like, I checked out some screenshots and, you know, some YouTube videos of the original Super Nintendo game, and they've definitely, the DS one, I mean, the text in it is completely changed and updated.
It's a new translation. It's kind of unnecessary, I think, because the original was a Ted Woolsey game, so...
Yeah.
It already had a good translation. This was post FF4 debacle.
Yeah.
Right.
So I'm not really sure what the point is of retranslating it when it was already good, but it's fine. I mean, I didn't notice anything majorly different when I played the DS one.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, I was kind of worried that I'm sort of missing some of the charm, because maybe, I mean, some of the charm of some of those older Square Enix games was the fact that some things were kind of phrased poorly. But it kind of added to the charm.
Got the virtual console version coming at some point, John.
I hope so. I may. I don't know.
Double dip.
I'm the king of the double dip.
Give Square your money twice.
Yeah.
Or three times if you bought it originally.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll see what happens. So I don't really know. That's pretty much the last thing I did. I got the Wings of Time. Actually, I went into the Mudbeast Den, and I got my ass handed to me by a couple of, like, there's like a fire Mudbeast and an ice Mudbeast. And I'd already been playing for a while, and so they kicked my ass, and I was just like, I just kind of turned it off and just vegged out. But
you're definitely in the part of the game now where you can choose to do a ton of optional side quests.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are really interesting. I mean, they pretty much all have some kind of story elements.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not just grinding for gear and stuff like that. You know, I mean, you will definitely get swords and armor and stuff that's powerful and will help you later on in the game, but you don't really have to do any of it. You could actually, I think at this point, you could technically go try to beat the game.
Yeah.
Once you get the time machine, you can go.
You'll lose. Badly.
Probably. You probably will lose, but it's certainly possible to beat him.
Yeah.
But if you go talk to the guru at the end of time, he'll give you like a list of things that you could go do, and they're pretty much all optional.
Okay.
So if you want some ideas, you can go talk to him. Some are easier than others.
But in terms of the plot itself is actually wrapping up.
You're getting very close.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure I'll clear out all the optional stuff. I mean, just because I really like the battle. I like making my characters incredibly strong and then just beating the crap out of everything. Even though I do get my ass kicked enough, but...
Well, you could enjoy New Game Plus then. That's how I enjoyed it. You know, if you just whack everything up to super fast, like the battle speed and the tech speed and everything, because you've already beaten once, you're really powerful, you could just blow through it when you're playing on the train. It's just curiously sort of satisfying to go through it kind of mindlessly, but so smoothly.
Yep.
I used to play a metagame for myself where I went through New Game Plus several times over. And basically, I would see how far I could get in the game before it took more than one hit to kill a boss. And my record was the giant machine in the future. The first time you go to the future, and you're in one of those domes, and you have to fight this big machine. And I could kill that in one hit, but I think whatever the next boss was, it took me two.
Yeah.
But,
so
yeah, it gets absurd after a while.
Yeah. So after that, I'll probably move on to Pokemon and not catch them all, but catch a substantial amount.
Catch more of them.
Catch more of them. And then I also picked up Amazon had Radiant Historia on sale, so I picked that up as well.
It's a very good follow up to Chrono Trigger.
Yeah. You know, I figured it would be a good kind of bookend to it.
It is. It's a longer game though, because I'm up to about 29 hours in Radiant Historia, and I'm not near the end. I can tell you. I probably play it slower than James does, but it's a big game, for sure.
I mean, I wouldn't have bought it if I didn't know that I was going to have the time to play it.
Well, you've clearly changed your approach to purchasing things, John.
He's a new man.
I am.
Give John a train, and he's a completely different person.
Yep, the train to New Johnsville.
Took him a long time.
It's boarding now. Everybody get on.
I don't want to get on that train. I want nothing to do with that train.
It's that woo, woo,
woo, woo.
I think this is an important point, you know, in America that's very possessive of its cars, that, you know, the positive externalities of public transport like this, what it's brought to John, his sanity to his purchasing.
And actually me playing games.
I prefer the American version of that, the future America, where we get in our cars and we tell them where to go, and then we take a nap or we play DS until we get there.
Yeah, that would be great.
You're still be playing your DS.
I would prefer that, for the record.
No, that it's coming. It's like, take me to see mom and dad in Alabama. 3 days later,
yep.
Climb out of the car. I've got a beard.
3 days later, you're in a Skynet concentration camp.
So yeah, Chrono Trigger.
Yeah,
Chrono what?
Hey, we're talking about the future, okay? It's pertinent. Well, speaking of the future, I have been playing Portal 2, which is really awesome, actually. And I should say that other than playing a shitload of Radiant Historia in the past week, TYP was over here last night. He unfortunately had to fly back to California before recording time tonight, so he wasn't able to be on the show like he is every now and then. But he did get to come over last night, went out and had some dinner, and then we played Smash Brothers for like 2 hours, Brawl. And that was a treat, because I never get to play Smash Brothers with anybody. So that was really fun. And of course, he's very good at it. But I think we ended up being about 50-50, because we've both rusted a lot in our skills, but I think he had farther to drop. So we ended up being fairly even. And we're using random characters too, so it's hard to pull any kind of meaningful statistics unless you play for like 12 hours. When you have everything random, it's just, there's so much variance. But again, I mean, we were talking about it as we played it, like, you play that game because it's funny. I mean, it is fun, but it's more funny than fun. And it's just, unfortunately, it's not funny when you play against the computer. So that's why I don't sit around and play Brawl by myself, you know, even though I like the game a lot. The thing that I like the most about it is that interaction with other people and the crazy, hilarious shit that happens when you're in a multiplayer match. And sadly, you can't get that. And I do like playing other games in multiplayer, but as we talked about before, in something like a racing game, even in Mario Kart, there aren't enough possibilities for what could happen. There's not enough interaction. You basically go forward and you turn and you shoot a weapon every now and then. And Smash Brothers is just so replete with Pokemon and trophies and, you know, all this crazy, crazy stuff that, you know, items falling out of the sky, bombs going off when you don't expect it, weird level stuff just knocking you right off. And as long as you don't take it seriously, you know, as long as you don't treat it as like a competitive fighting game,
you fools,
then it's insanely fun. I mean, the randomness of it is what makes it great. So, it was an amazing time. It was like, I haven't actually played Brawl nearly as much as I want to. I certainly have played it a fraction of the time that I put into Melee. But I had a roommate when I played Melee, and I played it every day for like 2 years at one point. So, I mean, that's never, you know, I may never play another video game that much again in my lifetime. So, in a sense, I feel like Brawl is almost a missed opportunity, even though I have the game, I really like the game. I've actually played it for dozens of hours, but it just doesn't feel like it, like I've really gotten what I could out of it because it's so expansive, you know. Anyway, it was nice to revisit that. But yes, Portal 2... I got this a couple days ago, and I still haven't beaten the single player. Of course, I'm not going to spoil anything for anybody because the game is very much about story. It's about surprising you with the environments, with the levels, with the pacing of doing some puzzles and then maybe not doing some puzzles for a while, or maybe doing more platforming or more story type stuff for a while, and then maybe going back to puzzles. So the way it's all put together is surprising, and that's part of the magic of it. But it is, ooh, it's an amazing game. I'm playing it on PS3, and I got that copy because I got that version because Valve promised it would be the best console version, and also because it includes a free PC copy of the game.
Yeah, you really can't go wrong.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know how much I need two copies of the same game, but at some point I might feel like playing Portal 2 on a computer. I haven't actually tested it to see if it will run on my computer. I have concerns. I think Valve's engines are usually pretty good at downscaling, but I remember when I got the Orange Box 3 years ago or whenever it was, it didn't run that great on my computer, so
yeah,
this game, it doesn't seem promising that it's going to run really well. But I might be getting a new computer soon anyway, so maybe I'll just save it for that. But Portal 2 is astonishingly good, really polished, and just so inventive and fun. And I mean, the reason I think Nintendo fans should play it, and I talked to TYP about it, and I was like, hey, you can come over and check out Portal 2. He's like, I have no interest in Portal 2.
Did he play Portal 1?
How can you not? It's a 3D platformer. This is, in some ways, a very natural evolution from Mario 64. It's in first person, yes, but
there are no space marines in it.
That's not really important. It's not a first person shooter.
It's not. It's like a puzzle game. I would say it's like Metroid, but it's not even like Metroid.
It's not a first person adventure. It's a first person platformer, I would say. It's a puzzle platformer.
It's a puzzle platformer, exactly.
It's very much play at your own pace. There's no pressure. If you fall down a pit, it just respawns you immediately. I mean, it's really just stick you in a room with all this crazy shit and you take your time and figure it out. Mm-hmm. And it feels amazing when you do. And the stuff that you do looks so insane. I mean, just this weird guttural sensation of like flying through these portals and being shot out and flying through the air and arranging these lasers and boxes all over the place and this insane configuration to get out of there. And when you finally figure it out, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe they actually expected me to figure that out because it's so crazy. And yet all the tools you need are there.
Yep.
And in fact, sometimes there are multiple solutions actually, which is really fun when you figure out one of those.
Yeah.
But it's an ingenious game, and it is already, I can tell, much longer than the first Portal, which was promised. And I wasn't really skeptical about it, but I was just kind of wondering how they would pull that off. And I think at this point I've already played it for longer than the first game was, and I don't seem to be, I don't think I'm near the end, because there's a lot of mechanics, you know, like new puzzle elements, like new things that you interact with that mm-hmm. I've heard about that I haven't seen yet. So I'm pretty sure that I'm not even near the end.
Yeah, that's what I really liked in the first Portal, where like there's kind of things where like, oh, well, now you can shoot things through other portals and they'll come out on the other side. Mm-hmm. And it just like opens up this entire new expanse of types of puzzles that they introduce. It's like really, really cool.
Well, what I was thinking about this today, The entire game, I mean, and this is why I call it a platformer. The entire game, the purpose of the game is to go from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. And the amazing thing is they give you a device that literally takes you from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. And yet the game isn't reductive.
Yeah.
Because they introduce all these concepts that make it very challenging to actually get yourself across this big pit, even though you have this insanely powerful portal gun that lets you do impossible things. It's just an ingenious game, mm-hmm. and I very highly recommend it. And in particular, I feel like Nintendo fans who are, you know, who have very high expectations for 3D platformers and games like that, and puzzle games for that matter. I mean, the way the puzzles are put together in this game are very much descended from Zelda puzzles and Mario puzzles and Wario puzzles and things like that.
Yeah, it's very much a Nintendo game in the sense that they take a very simple concept and layer depth upon it.
Yes, absolutely. It's a very gentle curve, I think, to learn what it's doing. And yet, it doesn't handhold you. It doesn't over-tutorialize you. It doesn't treat you like you're stupid. It often makes you feel stupid, but then it makes you feel like a genius.
Mm-hmm.
Just minutes later. So it's really a thrilling experience to go through these puzzle rooms. Anyway, looking forward to playing more of that. And there's a whole distinct co-op campaign too that I haven't touched at all yet. So it's almost like a bonus game in there. So I'm looking forward to that too. And the other big thing I've been playing this week is, oddly enough, Fallout New Vegas. And I would say this is the newest entry in my continuing gamers education series where I play things that other people play but I've never played before, and I'm not necessarily that interested in it for its own sake, but I'm kind of interested in what other people see in it. You know, like, I'm trying to be open to new experiences. I'm trying to, you know, I mean, a lot of the things I play because I know I will like it. And it's kind of like with books. Like, when I read books, I alternate between books that are really easy and enjoyable and appetizing for me and books that are more difficult but maybe more educational and enlightening. So I try to go back and forth. And I do a bit of the same thing in video games to a lesser extent. So Fallout New Vegas, I got it from Gamefly, and I think I actually let it sit on the table for 2 days before I ever put it in there because I just wasn't that excited to start playing it. You know, like, it was sort of a begrudging thing when I finally popped it in there. And man, the first couple hours of this game are brutal. The thing is, it tells you a lot of stuff. It explains a lot of what's going on in terms of the game mechanics, but it doesn't give you any kind of strategy for surviving or for where you need to go next or anything like that. I mean, it's an open world game. I mean, I think even though this is an RPG, it actually has a lot in common with something like Grand Theft Auto. And in some ways, I think the way this game handles things is better than the way Grand Theft Auto handles it in terms of the mission structure and the way that you accomplish things and how you're rewarded for doing things is actually better in Fallout. But I didn't play Fallout 3 at all, so I can't speak to that at all. I figured, why not just go with the newer one that's maybe slightly improved in some ways? And this game was supposed to be broken as hell when it first launched, but they've patched it up a storm since then. And I haven't really had any bugs other than some odd animation glitches here and there. But that, in a game like this, that's actually very common anyway. So I've been pretty happy with how stable it's been based on all the horror stories I'd heard. But Fallout New Vegas is essentially a game where it plops you out in the Mojave Desert, and it's, you know, post-nuclear apocalypse and all that. And basically the goal of the game is to roam around and explore and find places and people and complete missions for them. So it is very much an RPG. I mean, the combat is, even though it's first person and you do often use some kind of gun, if you try to play it like a first person shooter, you will die very quickly because it's a terrible shooter. I mean, it's possible to shoot guns in real time, but you should never do it because it's terrible. So pretty much you always want to hit the shoulder button and go into the VAT system, which basically pauses the game, lets you choose a body part to aim at. It tells you the percentage likelihood of you hitting it and how much damage it'll do. And then you push the button and it does it. So it's just like an RPG, basically. It becomes almost turn-based in that sense. And that's the proper way to play the game, and that works fine. So if you treat it like an RPG, and the nice thing is that even though I don't really like the combat that much, I think there's not that much depth to it, unfortunately. There's so much depth in everything else in the game that I don't really care. And the simple act of exploring, I mean, this is something I've talked about before, but one thing I love about video games is where they give you this big, interesting world and actually reward you for exploring it. And there are a lot of examples I've brought up many others in the past. This one should work. In some ways, it does work for me. I mean, it pings that little part of my brain that says, ooh, I found a new place, and they gave me experience points for it. Awesome. You know, I love that. The problem is the actual world that you're exploring is a post-nuclear desert. I mean, the Mojave Desert wouldn't be that interesting of a place to roam around in if it was set in present day, much less after nuclear holocaust has destroyed everything. So it's just all brown and gray and empty, and everything living there is either a person who's kind of nasty and rude or some giant mutated scorpion that wants to kill you. I mean, it's just not a joyful place whatsoever to explore. But, I mean, I like the trappings of the game. Like, I like the way that the game works. I think a lot of the missions are very interesting. The writing is pretty high quality for the most part. The game does open with the awful cliche, war. War never changes. And I was like, what? I mean, it's just a facepalm moment. Like,
well, it especially doesn't change after you've nuked it out of existence.
It gets a lot better after that.
Is that a reference to older Fallout games, I think? It's got to be for fan service thing. I feel confident of that.
I hope so.
This is basically the fourth-ish Fallout game. There's some add-on packs.
And isn't it? The whole thing with this Fallout is that it was developed by people who had developed the pre-Fallout 3 games.
Right.
Yeah. That have kind of been reconstituted into Obsidian. Is it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about Fallout New Vegas is that I almost quit playing it after like an hour because I felt like I didn't know what to do and the game was just out to get me. You know, I was dying over and over, just getting screwed. I was going in completely the wrong direction and just getting, you know, just murdered. And I mean, yes, that is a strength of the game that it's so open and nonlinear and it lets you do things kind of in whatever order you want. But in reality, there is kind of an order that you have to do things because it's the only way you'll actually get through it. So in practice, there is kind of a route that you will eventually make around the map to get up to New Vegas. And then later on, maybe you're a lot stronger. Maybe you can take the more direct route, but I've been playing for quite a bit, and I still can't even do that. So, in other words, it's more linear than you might think.
Is it more side questy?
Well, the thing is, I'm not even sure what the main quest is at this point. I mean, I guess I'm trying to find out who shot me in the intro, but I don't really feel like any of the things I've been doing are heading towards a conclusion to that story. So it's pretty much all side quests, and you just choose the ones that seem the most interesting or the ones that are the easiest to do. And you do those first, and then maybe a lot of times in the course of doing one quest, you open up two more. So it just, like, the list of possible things that you can do just gets longer and longer. And it is a very interesting game. I don't think I'll keep it for much longer because, again, my problem with the environment is just it's really not a world that I want to spend time in. It's just very ugly and depressing and hostile. It's just not really a fun place to walk around and explore, even though the walking around and exploring is kind of the best part of the game. And I think what I might like a lot more is maybe the Elder Scrolls game, Skyrim, that's coming out this fall. Because mm-hmm. I think it's more or less the same kind of game, but it's in this lush fantasy world that's very colorful, and it's got dragons and trees would be nice. Yeah. Like green shit.
Well, yeah. That's not really yeah. changed from the nuclear holocaust.
Water and trees would be kind of neat to look at. So maybe that'll be more up my alley, because the mechanics of the game, for the most part, I actually do like, and the RPG aspect of it is, it's been surprisingly engaging. I mean, I don't think of myself as a Western RPG fan. I've never really been able to get into one before, except maybe Mass Effect, and this is much more RPG-ish than either of the Mass Effect games, certainly far more than 2. So, you know, I'm not like a huge Fallout fan now, but I certainly have a lot more respect for this series, and I think I understand it more, and I think maybe it's going to lead me to try some other games that are similar, but maybe more attuned to my personal tastes. But it's been a good experience. I'm glad I tried it, for sure. All right, Greg, your turn.
Yep, well, I'm going to start with a quick mention of a demo that I downloaded from the Japanese PSN for El Shaddai Ascension of the Metatron. So this is from Ignition Entertainment.
Shane Co.
Fine publishers of nothing good.
Herr Bettenhausen works there these days.
James, they did Muramasa, which is pretty good.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, Ignition published Muramasa in America, but this is being developed by Ignition in Japan.
This might be their first game that they've actually developed internally.
I believe it is, yes.
Whereas, of course, you know, Muramasa was a marvelous game in Japan.
Yeah.
So the pedigree of this is that it's been directed by the chap who was the character designer for stuff like Devil May Cry and Okami.
That's a bit like handing the set designer over the directory reins for the sequel. But
well, it's a brief demo, so I haven't got a great idea of the gameplay. But I mean, the main reason why I downloaded it was to look at it. I mean, you could obviously get something of an idea in video, high quality videos online and stuff, but much more so when you can actually play it for yourself. And it is basically like an acid trip. I mean, it is actually, to me, and not that I ever actually played this game, but it's more evocative of Killer 7 than it is Okami. Mm. Because, yeah. You know, it's cel-shaded, you know, it's got that very sort of sparse on detail, you know, stark use of colour, and just whacked out, surreal, acid trip kind of stuff going on. So that you pick up in the demo, you play as Enoch from the Dead Sea Scrolls, I guess, the Book of Enoch, or Nucky to his friends. And so he's like this guy that's got, like, he's in armor, but underneath he's got designer jeans on, which you see when you get hurt. Like, there's no HUD to the game at all, which I think is very appropriate because it kind of helps preserve the sort of purity of the surrealism.
Is purity the right word here?
Just, well, no, it's just like, you know, a sort of living canvas of surrealist craziness, like, so it's not spoiled by a HUD or anything. I think that's quite a nice decision. So just go through the demo. You've got two core components. You've got your kind of character action, third person 3D kind of combat stuff, where the core mechanics that I sort of identified, and of course it's in Japanese, so I couldn't really pick up what it was telling me to do other than press these buttons in general. But it seems to be like you can disarm enemies at certain times and like take their weapon and kind of purify it and use it for yourself. Mm-hmm. So that, other than that, it seemed pretty simple. You're just kind of using one button to attack, one button to block. So, yeah, there was nothing too advanced there. And then the other kind of component to the game was this side-scrolling platforming, which was, again, pretty basic. A little odd, you're kind of using the analog stick to control it, and it's got the same kind of jump physics and feel to it as in the 3D parts. So I don't know how well that's really going to play if they try and ratchet it up as it goes on and make the platform layouts more complex.
Yeah, I've heard Shane Bettenhausen say that the game is actually like approximately half 2D gameplay. So there's a lot of that, and I'm sure it gets more complex and demanding later on.
I'm not sure. Maybe you get used to it, but, you know, obviously, considering it does, I guess, to some extent, have to have some sort of consistency with the other facet of the gameplay, it just feels weird. Mm. But, you know, basically, you just have this, like, face just sort of appears out of nowhere and blows all the environment in opposite directions while you're jumping, which makes it more difficult to kind of see where you're going and stuff. It's bizarre. And then the very end of the demo, sort of giant boss character appears. It's like, oh we've got to fight the boss. And then this very fashionably dressed chap, all in black, appears. So clicks his finger.
Oh, I think he's meant to be Satan, actually.
I later discovered he's Lucifer.
Yeah, like pre-fall of Satan, Lucifer.
Before he was evil, he spent a lot of time in stylish boutique stores, apparently.
Of course.
Well, he's like Merlin. He travels through different periods of time, I think is what the game says.
His penchant for sort of all black is a little bit reminiscent of when Spider-Man's acting like a cock in the third one.
So the whole movie.
I love that part. God,
definitely a lot more macho and, you know, than Tobey Maguire. But, like, he talks to you for a little while. I don't know whether he's explaining something or what the hell he's doing, and he just snaps his fingers again, and the boss battle sort of appears to be beginning, and that's the end of the demo. So
Satan's such a tease. God.
Yeah, it didn't exactly give you a whole lot to go on, but it was, I mean, it's definitely visually one of the more interesting games you'll lay eyes on, but I mean, it's not something that I'm like really hyped for or anything. It's just out of curiosity, and I guess I'll wait for reviews to see how well the final product holds up.
I think it's out in a week in Japan.
Yeah, it is very shortly in Japan.
I remember this game being featured very, very prominently at Ignition's booth at E3. And by that, I mean every physical surface they could was covered in promotional material for this game. Mm-hmm. And I remember somewhere between the ear-splitting voice acting of the RPG I was there to view, looking up at this giant screen they had playing scenes from this game and being convinced that she had slipped me some kind of drug.
It is that one.
It was the most visually bizarre thing I saw all week, and we went to a press event where flamethrowers were shot off. So
this and a girl pole danced about 50 feet up a pole to the ceiling.
Yes, and Tony Hawk was supposed to come down on a ramp from the ceiling, but the ramp broke.
So I'll move on now. So Okami Den, I've played very much more of it in the past week. I've finished it now. It's a good-sized game, somewhere in the sort of 50-20-hour range. It would probably take you to finish it.
Shorter than the original, then?
Oh, it's certainly short. The original's really quite long, though.
It's almost too long. A lot of people think it's too long.
I would say it was a bit long for my taste. I mean, it's one of these things that you could probably apply this to Bioshock as well, in my case, where on the one hand, it's really cool surprise when you get like a substantial amount of content after a particular point where you might think that's basically the climax.
Yeah.
But then, you know, when that just kind of drags on for a bit, it's like the surprise fades and then it's like, yeah, this is just going on too long.
Well, right. I think it's more of a problem in Bioshock because that game's inherently repetitive, whereas Okami, they keep giving you new abilities and, you know, new dungeons. There's more design into...
There's more new gameplay content after that rather than just the narrative.
Yeah, Bioshock is all set... It's like all the design in that game goes into the world and the basic interaction that you have with the enemies in that game.
Yep.
And you see all of that in like the first 30 minutes. And after that, it's like, well, there's a twist in the story, but other than that, you pretty much do the same shit for 12 hours.
Yeah, you're fighting the same five enemies.
Could have been 6 hours and done this, all the same stuff, went to the same places, would have had more fun. But anyway.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But so with this, it is shorter, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's more briskly paced by any means. I mean, it's still quite slow, you know, which I probably have more tolerance for that on a portable in some respects. Although if it's one of these situations where, you know, you might be looking to just play it for a short burst but still accomplish something tangible,
right.
you might be a little disappointed on occasion.
I was going to say, for me, that's why I like the portable games to be snappier, because I want to do something.
I honestly, that depends on the setting in which I'm playing them. For instance, you know, like, am I kind of killing time on a fairly long trade journey like John's doing? Or, you know, am I playing something at home in between doing something else?
Yeah.
So you just have to kind of put it in the appropriate setting, I think, and it's fine. I mean, the first thing actually has kind of occurred to me when we were recording last week's show, where Johnny was talking about Radiant Historia. He was saying what he liked about the storytelling is that it was grown-up characters talking to each other in a grown-up fashion.
Yes.
And, you know, it was not like Golden Sun or whatever with its emoticons. And the inference I've drawn from that is that Johnny might struggle to enjoy Okami Den.
Well, because they're inherently children.
They're all kids. All the characters are, you know, cute little kids and a puppy.
Honestly, I had fairly little patience for the storytelling in Okami to begin with. I mean, I recently had a friend over, and it was on my mind because of Okami Den and et cetera. And so I booted the game up, and I just wanted to show it to this friend. You know, I wanted to show him the graphics because the graphics are amazing, even on the PS2, maybe especially on the PS2, actually. But I didn't have a save file for it because it's long gone, I guess. So I started a new game, and 30 minutes later, I'm still scrolling through text waiting for my chance to run around and show him what this game looks like. It's like, good grief, I can't believe I just sat through this again.
Well, I mean, certainly the beginning, as we sort of touched on last week, is with these sorts of games, is always an issue for me. You know, Okami, Twilight Princess, and this one, you know, I do wish they would get on with it a bit quicker. Although, I mean, here, the cutscenes are all skippable, but the problem is, in certain cases, I could imagine if you did skip them, you'd be like, what the heck? Where am I?
What's going on?
A minute ago, I was in somewhere, you know, like just in the field, and now I'm in an ice cave, you know.
To be clear, you cannot skip them in the original Okami. You can sort of mash X over and over to make the text scroll slightly faster, but you can't skip them.
Yeah, with this, you can just press for the real cutscenes. You can just press select and skip them all together if you really want, which I'm sure would speed things up. But, you know, there's, like I said, it would probably be a bit disorienting. But, I mean, the script, you know, as I said, inherently, it's a lot of, you know, it's kids, you know, interacting with this silent protagonist puppy. You know, a lot of what happens, so it's like, you know, they'll say something or do something, and then the other characters will react with one of those anime, like, comic giant beads of sweat coming down their temple, yeah. Or the rain clouds forming over their head because they've come up with a nickname that Chibi-Terasu doesn't like. Yeah, so if you haven't got a tolerance for that kind of thing, because you were talking about the emoticons in Golden Sun, I think you might struggle with this, because if you do watch the cutscenes, they are quite time-consuming. And I mean, it's adorable, it's cute. I mean, the Chibi-Terasu character is absolutely one of the most cutest things that's ever been in a video game, and I can appreciate that personally, but it doesn't certainly make it go any quicker. I guess the real problem is just that the writing is not witty enough to sustain it for me. You know, there's not enough of that clever, maybe subtext or something you might get in, you know, some of the Nintendo localized stuff like Mario and Luigi, or,
right,
you know, where it's kid friendly, but there's these different levels that it works on. I don't think it works in that way at all. And there's some odd issues. Every now and again, there's some sloppiness in the localization, like there's a word missing here, there, or and you know, it doesn't feel like it was perhaps given the maximum sort of love that goes into some localizations, which, given what we've heard about Capcom's approach to bringing over some of these games, I imagine they probably didn't, you know, splash the cash as much as they might have done on the localization budget, given they probably had very modest expectations for what the game could do. But, I mean, all in all, the narrative is passable. I mean, at times it kind of rehashes some of the same ground as Okami. Towards the end, it gets a little more interesting, just because it starts to more kind of connect with the Okami story rather than just redo it, mm-hmm. which is nice. But it was never really a big highlight for me in this one. But I did enjoy it overall, because I think, first of all, it does an incredible job of, I think, given the limitations of bringing over the aesthetic, a lot of the gameplay mechanics, you know, still work very well. I mean, the brush stuff, using the touchscreen for the celestial brush, is generally pretty satisfying, you know, pretty effective in terms of the recognition and stuff. It gets a bit more finicky towards the end once you've got, like, the ability to do gusts of winds as well, as so it gets more picky about closing your circles and things. But generally, you know, the actual act of drawing on the touchscreen is so much faster than anything you did in the old games.
Yeah.
So that kind of negates some of the issues of the switching, but it can be bothersome when you're doing multiple things in a row, which will happen more and more as you get later in the game. You know, for instance, there's quite a few sections where you'll be guiding your partner character over, because it's got a sort of spirit tracks style, you know, the spirit tower parts of spirit tracks, you know, where Zelda is in the phantoms.
Yeah.
The whole game, you have a partner character, and you'll often separate, so you'll flip them off your back, and then use the stylus to tell them where to go. And so you'll stop the game, tell them to go somewhere, and then some enemy characters will kind of float into view and threaten to, you know, cut them off from their path. So what you need to do is then, again, stop it with the shoulder button to trigger the celestial brush, slash one enemy, he goes a little further, oh, there's another one, bring it up, slash it again. Then he gets to where he needs to go, and then you can draw a line from Chibi-Terasu to the partner to then reunite. And so that might be four or five celestial brush actions in a very short space of time. Then it's too much. And the fact that you can only really do one action at once.
So you can't sequence up multiple slashes and then let go of the shoulder button and they all go off.
No, I mean, for instance, as far as I know anyway, I mean, I kind of took it as given a lot of the time, because there'd be certain instances, say, like where it'd be in a combat phase and you've got a couple of enemies, the clamshell ones. And so what happens when you stun them, you want to draw a circle around them so they open up to reveal their core, and then you can kill them. And I, you know, I would try and open them up both at once, and it would never recognize that. Mm. Whereas if I did it one by one, it would. So that those sections could certainly get a bit bogged down, and that adds to this general kind of slow pace.
Well, I know one of our listeners mentioned in Talkback for last week's episode that he wasn't bothered by the screen switching thing because it sort of gives you time to grab your stylus. Which makes sense, but I guess there's probably a lot of variation in how different people hold the stylus, so it may not take you that long.
What I tended to do is just have it in my hand the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, just clenched while holding the system. I mean, you could easily do that, and it just removes the need to keep taking it out, because it would get kind of irksome a lot of the time. But, I mean, with the combat, for instance, it is a little bit, you know, kind of dumbed down from where it would have been on the consoles, because you've only got the D-pad and a few buttons rather than, you know, all the sticks and dodging and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you've got pretty simple set of actions, but it still works pretty well. But I think where it really succeeds, definitely my favorite parts of the game, are the bosses. Because not only are they very impressive visually, you know, they exhibit a lot of the same kind of spectacle and, you know, just really cool use of the Okami aesthetic as they did in the original console game. But yeah, they have probably the most satisfying use of the celestial brush in the gameplay. Little sort of puzzles involving, you know, like you have this fish that attacks you, but you can use the sort of vine power to like string it up and then attack it for a while before it goes back in. And you can use the partner characters play into it quite a lot, which, I mean, I really like that part of Spirit Tracks. And the thing is, there's nothing anywhere near on the level of the same intricacy here in terms of, you know, some of the puzzles in the Spirit Tower are quite complicated in Spirit Tracks, whereas here it's generally pretty simple. But I think the bosses is probably where it's the most clever. They are just really cool encounters. Elsewhere, I just don't think they fully capitalized on the partner stuff. You know, very often it's just kind of like, oh, well, you know, here's a section which Chibi-Terasu can't traverse. Let me just draw him over there and then I'll connect them up later. You know, there's just variants on that very often. And, you know, the first so many times it works well enough, but there's just not enough development there. So that's probably be my general feelings on it. It's very pleasant, but it's also a bit lightweight. You know, in terms of the story, in terms of the gameplay, it's just lacking a bit of substance, which, you know, I guess Okami, you know, the original had some more, you know, and this be a bit of a kind of a junior version in a way. You know, it's the kind of thing that used to happen a lot more on portables, where they couldn't really do like a proper conversion of something.
Right.
So they did a kind of alternate version that shares a lot of the same things in common. I guess Donkey Kong Land, you know, is kind of like that. I never played those, you know, where it's like, it's not literally the same game as Donkey Kong Country, but it kind of wants to be.
There was a lot of that on the Game Boys, and it kind of went away in the DS stuff.
But, you know, I wouldn't say it's so much less substantial than its console, you know, brother, because that was a lot about style. For me,
yeah.
I mean, I never was satisfied with Okami on the level of puzzle solving, for instance, that I was in Zelda, you know, Twilight Princess or...
No. But it had really fun, sort of complex combat, and it was so damn Japanese.
Yeah.
Really stylish. Just still one of the most stylish games I've ever seen.
It was about the aesthetic. It was about the atmosphere. And as I said, that is brought across very admirably here. And it does have some of its own personality. It does have some of its own wrinkles. Like I said, where they use the partner mechanic well, I really like that. But I just don't think they went far enough with it. They could have done so much more. So it's a very admirable effort, and it is enjoyable, I think, in the right context, but it doesn't quite feel like it's as daring as it could have been, perhaps because, you know, there is such a reverence for what was done with the original Okami that they didn't want to, you know, tread too far outside of that.
I guess it's admirable that they got it as close as they did to the original, considering that pretty much all of the people who made the original no longer work at Capcom. I mean, in some sense, they never did work at Capcom, and they sort of did, you know. So this was made by pretty much completely different people, and I think maybe that might sort of inform why the game doesn't take many risks. And
well, I think Capcom felt like the biggest risk they were taking was just trying to make this game.
Just trying to sell it?
Just trying to build a sequel to Okami, but to manage to keep the visual aesthetics on a DS. I think they probably felt like, all right, we've taken enough risk now. We don't have to screw around with the formula any.
Well, you know, I mean, things like Phantom Hourglass proved a lot about what you can do with the DS and put a 3D game on there.
This is a little bit different because it's not quite that isometric stuff. I mean, it's going...
Yeah, I mean, the way it works is, you know, when you're playing in, like, the towns and the fields and all that, you know, it will look very similar to the console game, the way it uses the camera and stuff, although there's obviously a lot more auto camera, which the auto camera tends to help with the D-pad navigation, because if you just kind of hold forward, it'll guide you through the curved paths and all that, you know, that you've got there. So, you know, it handles that kind of stuff well, but then when you go into, like, what approximates kind of dungeon type section, then it will move to more of a Spirit Tracks, Phantom Hourglass kind of top down-ish view.
I think this is pretty much the embodiment of what Capcom is as a company, though, which is it's a markedly conservative company, capable of moments of great just willingness to try something insane.
I think trying to recommend the game, the main question you've got to ask yourself is, you know, are you kind of amenable to this game's sort of general atmosphere? But first of all, I mean, if you've played Okami before, but it kind of reminds me of what Johnny said about Crackdown 2, but that's a bit uncharitable. If you want to kind of relive it, but also relive it in a different way, then Okami Den, I think, is kind of a cool way to do it, because mentioned last week, it'll evoke memories of playing the previous game. But on the other hand, of course, we must assume that not everyone has played the original Okami, so...
Most people, in fact, have
yes.
not played.
So, you know, maybe look up some videos, you know, listen to some music, you know, just kind of feel like whether this is a kind of world that you want to go to for, you know, 20 hours or so on your DS.
Okay, well, that's new business, and now we'll take a break. When we come back, Now Playing and your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, Now Playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
In features, we have the best 3DS games, which is not necessarily saying these are the best games on the DS, but the staff has voted on our best DS games.
Listen to the backpedaling. No, this is the definitive list.
It's not definitive at all. You shut the hell up.
Definitely go see what the fuss is about. It's a good list, too, and it'll take you down memory lane.
Right. In more, Neil, we have our latest edition of Extra Life for the rare NES board game, Anticipation. We played this at PAX East, and his write-up for it includes some thoughts and some interesting photos of the multiplayer experience.
Yeah, I looked on the front page, and everybody looks like they're having a real good time playing that game. And on the review front, we have a review of Rayman 3D. Jimmy J. James Jones has the final word on this classic, quote-unquote classic platformer's latest port. Is it off with his head and arms and legs?
That's terrible.
Oh,
John, are you ghostwriting? No, there's no penis reference, obviously not.
I give John the goodies when it comes to Now Playing.
And another review, Tiger Woods PGA Tour 12, The Masters. Danny serves up some love for this game of sticks, which might be the first title to support both Motion Plus and the balance board.
I assume you can use both at the same time, which I would like to see someone do.
Tiger Woods Mistress Mode revealed with motion blur in the balance board.
He's barely on the cover at all, John.
He really is. They really did try to mitigate Mr. Woods in this particular edition of the game.
All right, well, we have a new feature. It's the rumor roundup for Nintendo's next console. James actually has summarized all the current rumors into one convenient location, and we're going to be updating the article whenever new information arrives, so be sure to check it out to make sure you haven't missed anything and come back frequently for the latest rumors.
And not the crazy ones, the ones that kind of have some substance and possible sources behind them.
We also have another feature. It's the 3DS Owner's Manual. So whether you're a proud new 3DS owner or still waiting to pick one up, this thorough FAQ is packed with useful information from both James and Carl, with some input from Neil, I believe. And this one will also be updated from time to time, so it's worth bookmarking.
And in another feature, we have Nick Street Pass Adventures, in which one of our Aussie correspondents, Nicholas, traveled cross-island to a nerd convention called Supernova, a perfect testing ground for Street Pass and other 3DS features. Find out how many hits he scored at this busy event. And finally, we have a little note here that we are now hiring a website programmer. We're looking for some help on the technical side. If you'd like to be part of the NWR team and have some mad skills in crazy things like Java, HTML5, and SQL, please email nwrjobs@nintendoworldreport.com or check out this blog post for more info. Working on a big site like NWR is excellent experience and looks great on a resume.
Indeed it does. Okay, that's it for this week. Definitely go check out all of this great content over at NintendoWorldReport.com, plus the latest news and reviews and all that. All that jazz. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail. We're very happy to catch up on some emails here from the past couple of weeks. Of course, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Send them anytime, folks. James has the first letter.
I do, and it's from Voodoo. He asks, I have three questions for you guys regarding favorite video game systems, past and present. He might be over his quota here. First, what is your favorite Nintendo system, console or portable? Please ignore the Virtual Console, as it will likely unfairly tip the scale in favor of the Wii.
Damn.
Do you want to answer this first?
Well, the Wii has kind of an upper hand because it plays GameCube games, and it does have the Virtual Console, so it plays all those other games.
So ignore that.
But it's hard to. I mean, it's the most versatile Nintendo console for sure.
That's the favorite console from a kind of utilitarian point of view, whereas, mm-hmm. you know, like, what's your favorite console era? You know, the games that came out in that era, I guess, is probably what Voodoo's more interested in here.
Right.
Super Nintendo.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the NES just because, you know, it had such a broad range of games and, you know, a lot, like so many, obviously so many classic titles. The Super NES, a close second, but it really didn't have the sports titles that the NES had. There were a lot of classic sports
no,
titles.
No, it had RPGs.
Yeah,
which
it had
is
a lot of RPGs and a lot of, you know, great action games, but it was pretty lacking on the sports end of the spectrum.
The Super NES kind of caught up with sports towards the end. You know, they started to get more of the EA stuff and all that.
Mega Man Soccer.
They did, but they were always inferior versions.
Yeah, the Genesis will always be associated with those games more.
Yep.
And that was, I guess that was in part because of Nintendo's awful, awful relationship with EA. Toxic would be the word to describe it.
Well, and also, I mean, Sega kind of engendered a good one because didn't they, like, let EA make their own cartridges and stuff, you know, so they were basically Sega were taking a much lesser cut of the whole thing, and it was just
yeah,
much
more flexible.
Yeah,
and they did look different, too.
Yeah, oh, yeah, they had those, like, I don't know, at least in Europe, they had
yellow
those
tabs?
Big yellow tabs. Yeah,
they looked hideously ugly.
Yeah, EA seemed like they never really had a full grasp of the Super NES hardware.
I think they just said, Genesis is our lead platform, we've established a fan base there, oh yeah, and fuck you, Nintendo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the market. I mean, the market was there, and at some point, the Super Nintendo user base was such that you wouldn't ignore it, but it didn't necessarily mean you prioritized it either.
Right.
Me answering this question, again, there's a bit of a divide, because I think if you're going to talk about which console or portable I got the most use out of and had the most different kinds of experience out of and all this kind of stuff, I mean, DS is such a strong candidate.
Yeah.
It's probably my number two.
I played a lot of kinds of games I hadn't played before. I enjoyed a lot of different kinds of games that I wouldn't have enjoyed before because it was portable or because of like the touch interface made things easier or this, that, and the other. But it also had a lot of the kinds of experiences that I dearly love from back in the day, like Castlevanias and Contras and, you know, Henry Hatsworth, Bangoyo, and then like your puzzle games like Picross. I mean, it just, it keeps going. It's so vast. It's pretty difficult to compete with that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, when you say favorite, Super Nintendo is very special for me. And it is, the Super Nintendo, I think, is very special for a home console in that it's the last time that you had Nintendo's output, you know, which was excellent about, you know, your Super Metroid, the Link to the Past, you know, Super Mario World. I mean, you know, they were hitting their series with some of the best entries there's ever been in them. But at the same time, you also had certainly the best of Japanese third parties on the same platform. So you were getting Capcom's best, you were getting Square's best, you were getting Konami's best. You know, that is an incredible era to look back on now because this has not been repeated. So that deciding between those two is pretty difficult. I think, like I said, if you go utilitarian, I'll go DS. If I go emotional, I'll go Super Nintendo.
James?
This is difficult for me because, as I've mentioned on the show before, I lived an extended NES era. Because I didn't get the Super Nintendo until basically it was in its death throes. And even then it was sort of a hand-me-down situation. And I had the hand-me-down software that came with it that included my all-time favorite SNES game of Bill Laimbeer's Combat Basketball.
Oh, man.
Awesome.
Shooting missiles at people. And,
yeah.
Fucked. It's such an amazingly fucked game.
Aren't there teleports?
Something like that. It's totally whacked. So for me, I got in on the N64 while the console was still alive, such as it is for that system. So,
while it was writhing on the ground, you mean?
It wasn't dead. There was still a pulse. It was just a very faint one. So for me, that it has kind of a special feeling to it because, you know, when you went essentially from the NES for years to the SNES, with using PC gaming to really supplement your existence and handheld gaming, it was a huge transition. I mean, it was literally like games suddenly changed in every conceivable way for me. And it sort of really brought me back into doing gaming as one of my primary time killers in place of things like television. I mean, obviously I have other hobbies, but it sort of eked TV out, essentially. It drove it from where it had previously been sort of the dominant factor in killing time when I've got nothing else to do.
Yeah, for me, the internet was when my family got the internet, that was when I stopped watching TV. For 10 years, I probably pretty much didn't watch anything on TV for 10 years.
But from this weird, this isn't my favorite system per se, but the system that at the time, for me, was the biggest wonder, and this is going to be really stupid, but it was the Virtual Boy. Because it was like nothing I'd ever seen before. At all. I mean, even the
sure.
system itself is like...
By default?
why is there a water tower built into the... Oh, you put your eyes there? Oh my god, what's with this controller? It's hideous. Wow. And until I actually had one and played it through extended periods of time, it was always kind of this weird novelty in my head that I idealized, even though I knew it wasn't good. And in a way, I still kind of idealize it because it's so out there. It's so ridiculous. It's so early 90s in a way, or mid 90s, I guess, at that point. It's kind of magic.
It is.
It's essentially Nintendo's attempt at channeling their magic in a new way and it exploding in just complete chaos. And for whatever reason, I kind of have these feelings of appreciation for that system because of what it is.
Well, we can. Voodoo's second question was, assuming everyone chose the DS as their favorite, which we obviously didn't, what is your second favorite? So we sort of have already covered that, some of us. But I do want to say, I want to give some credence to the GameCube because I think I'm not as nostalgic for GameCube, partly because it's more recent, of course. And I think the GameCube loses something because the Wii is fully backwards compatible, so
right.
It's not as unique. It's not as cemented in one era. You know, I still play. I mean, I played GameCube games this past weekend on the Wii, So the GameCube, it's not as special, maybe, but when I think about the hundreds, maybe thousands of hours I played Melee and the very magical experience it was with, like, Metroid Prime 1 and 2 and even Wind Waker and even maybe Pikmin, I think there's a strong case to be made for that. The main thing being that the GameCube doesn't have as well-rounded of a library for me as the Super Nintendo. It doesn't have the RPGs. It doesn't have the third-party games. It doesn't have the Mega Mans and the Castlevanias and stuff that I like on Super Nintendo. So,
well, actually, it has all of your Super Nintendo Mega Mans.
Yeah, okay, sort of, yeah, technically. But you know, it didn't have the new stuff. Like, by the GameCube, I really felt like I was starting to miss out if I didn't play things on other systems. Whereas with Super Nintendo, not really. I mean, I'd had a Super Nintendo for a couple years before we got a Genesis, and I had like three games for Genesis. You know, I would occasionally rent something. I always felt like, oh, I definitely picked the right horse from the start here. You know, like, yeah. I had a Genesis. I don't dislike the Genesis, but I never felt like the Genesis was competing for me with Super Nintendo. There was a clear dominance in my household.
I never owned one and never missed it, so.
Right. I mean, I had a Mega Drive, and we pretty much just played all those aforementioned sports games. You know, that was pretty much, it was the sports game player, you know, FIFA, yeah. Madden, NHL, NBA Jam.
I never
PGA
played sports
Tour.
Games. So for me, it was basically a Sonic and X-Men machine. And Sonic, I sort of played despite itself, and X-Men, I own the first one, and I rented the second one. That's pretty much all I ever played on Genesis, actually.
I mean, there's games on the Mega Drive that I would have really enjoyed had I been exposed to them, namely Treasure Stuff and some of the shooters. But
oh, yeah. I didn't know what Gunstar Heroes was until I was in college.
You know, because I was wired in on the Nintendo side, I didn't really hear so much about that. And also, because we had a PAL Mega Drive, those games would have been really badly compromised had I bought them anyway. So I never got anywhere near the kind of use out of the Mega Drive that, you know, I did at the Super Nintendo for various reasons.
I would have loved Gunstar Heroes, Phantasy Star, stuff like that, if I'd known that it existed back then.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I mean, I knew about Sonic. Okay, James, can you finish up Voodoo's Letter real quick?
Sure. Finally, what's your favorite non-Nintendo system?
Yeah, this one's a little bit tougher for me.
Well, I'll go first because it's very easy, because I've only ever owned two non-Nintendo systems. One of them was the Mega Drive, which I just discussed I barely used, so it kind of has to be the PS3. Really isn't anywhere else to go.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's interesting. I mean, if...
Could you say PC?
Well, that's the thing, right? If you're going computers, Commodore 64, easily. I fucking loved the Commodore 64. I mean, it's still to this day, I mean, the fact that, like, I mean, you could get so many pirated games off your friends, it wasn't even funny. and the thing is, they had so many quirky games on it.
Did you program on it?
No, but there were so many quirky games, too. I mean, because every single game you got was pirated for it, you would get, like, all of these weird games from Europe, and just, like, just kind of quirky games that you would just be like, wow, this is just totally wild, but really, really cool. So, yeah, I love the Commodore 64. Probably for consoles, I really actually liked the TurboGrafx-16. I had one of those, and I loved that console. Unfortunately, there, like, no games came out for it, really, but...
Well, because nobody owned it.
Well, shooters came out for it.
Yeah, shooters came out for it, like...
Lords.
You know, stuff like that.
Yeah, lords of stuff like that, exactly.
Yeah, but yeah, it had a couple of games that I just really, really liked, and... Everything about it was just kind of, it was just very unique. Like, it, you know, they didn't, instead of cartridges, they had the little hue cards, they called them.
Like, yeah,
little, everything about it was just very, very goofy.
For me, it's a pretty easy answer because of process elimination. It's got to be my 360 because it's the only one I've owned that I actually really got any significant playtime out of.
Yeah, that's you and me both, James, with different consoles, but.
Yes.
Yeah, see, Genesis was my first non-Nintendo system, and then, and then I've owned PS1, PS2, and PS3, but I might still have to go with 360. And it's maybe just because a lot of the multi-platform games I've played on 360 instead of PS3, even though I could have played it on PS3. But I think I've spent a lot more time with my 360. But, you know, if I'm going to get nostalgic, I might say PC, because I used to play a lot of PC games. I played me a hell of a lot of King's Quest 6 and 7 and 8. Yes, 8. I know someone out there is like, what? And a whole lot of TIE Fighter. I mean, a shitload of TIE Fighter I used to play. And
I feel like I missed out on a lot of classic PC games because I never had a PC capable of running them. Mm. And there was like a whole big spot there in like the late 80s.
I struggled to get mine working.
90s, like early 90s, where there were just some amazing games.
I played a lot of PC games, and I guess if we're willing to include them, it wins. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm not sure how much flexibility Voodoo's giving us in our questions. But then again, considering what I do to him in the forums, I really don't care. I'll answer it however the hell I want. And I'm going to say my car and F you, Voodoo. There.
Well, with PC games, it's interesting because I have a feeling that there's probably a lot of people out there who, if they were never really part of the PC scene at a certain time period, if they went back and played the games from that time period, they would be like, wow, this feature or style or, you know, game mechanic that I thought started with this console game actually started 2 years before on a PC game that basically they ripped off and put it on a console because they thought it was such a great idea.
Yeah, I've never considered myself a PC gamer, but every time my family would, and we didn't even have a PC till I was probably 12, but every time we got a new PC, which was like maybe every 3 or 4 years, we'd get some new games with it. It would probably come with a couple, and then I'd figure out how to get a couple more. You know, I might buy one or get one from a friend. So there were a lot of good times playing PC games, and I don't necessarily think about all that stuff all that often, but it was actually kind of an important time for me. So
yeah,
you can maybe consider that. Anyway, kind of a fun question to look at, but we got to move on.
Anonymous writes, it seems that there are very few games, if any, that run at full 60 frames per second in 1080p on the Xbox 360 or the PS3. Most games seem to be running at 30 frames per second in 720p as standard practice. Do you know, or can you find out, if Nintendo's next console will be able to run and display games at 60 frames per second in full 1080p? Or will it internally render the games at a lower resolution and simply upscale that to the TV just as the current gen systems are doing?
No. The end.
There's no way we can say for right now.
An important thing to note is very often, well, not necessarily very often, but there are some notable cases where even the actual resolution is lower than 720p. And it's being,
Call of Duty does that.
It's Call of Duty. PS3 gets like certain ports of games like Red Dead that kind of that have to do that, whereas like the 360 one doesn't, I guess, just because of the way they ported it, even though the PS3 is theoretically more powerful, at least in some ways. Halo 3 did it. I mean, there's loads don't really, you know, output at 720p. But I mean, the point is, you know, obviously we don't know. So something like the PS3 is capable of output at 1080p. The Pixel Junk games run in 1080p, for instance, quote unquote full HD.
But also the art style of those games, you can't tell.
It's very basic.
They look kind of low res, no matter what resolution they run at, because they look like they're made out of like paper cutouts and stuff like that.
And that actually helps them be able to do it. I mean, what he's asking is actually really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, 60 frames per second is a big demand, and to output it at 1080p is...
Well, PC games do it all the time.
Yeah, but PC games also have a lot more powerful hardware than console systems.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, just for the consoles that are on the market at the moment, it's just a bit too much for them.
Right. I mean, and it's not like your eye is really going to make a huge difference for the average person, especially unless you're watching on a huge TV. It's really not...
Yeah, it doesn't really merit, you know, the extra effort, or maybe to the extent that there is a trade-off, you know, would you rather have it at 1080p and have a lower frame rate? Probably not.
No, I'd much rather have the frame rate.
You'd rather upscale it and have the frame rate be consistent, because that's much more noticeable, as James kind of alludes to. So in terms of what, you know, the next console, I mean, everyone seems to be agreeing that it will be able to output 1080p, but like, as we see with the PS3, just because it can doesn't mean the games will run in that. I mean, that's going to depend on, you know, how powerful it is, you know, and if it's roughly comparable with the current systems, then we can assume that generally it won't run in 60 frames 1080p. And the other thing I would say is that I certainly don't expect Nintendo to demand any standards of the, they may well not mandate a game to be in like real HD or anything. I mean, if for any reason someone wanted to make a standard definition game, they might be willing to approve that in where Microsoft wouldn't.
Right, explicitly would reject it.
Anyway, again, I wouldn't expect to get dramatically different results than the current HD consoles if the technology in the next Nintendo system ends up being similar to what's already out there. I expect it will be a little bit better, of course.
Right.
But maybe not a significant leap.
When you get to this level of power, you know, going beyond what we've come to expect from the current HD systems, certainly what Nintendo has said in the past about diminishing returns and all that is really, you know, coming into play.
Yeah. That stuff becomes true at some point.
And I don't think Nintendo, who, you know, obviously went from a period of being, you know, well, like, not that many people have HD TVs yet, so we're perfectly justified in releasing a non-HD console. And obviously, you know, HD TV adoption has gone through the roof since then, but I don't think they're then going to become a company that becomes at all interested in, you know, the difference between 720p and 1080p, and making any sacrifices for that.
Yeah, they never chase numbers.
They chase some numbers. Cash, son. Cash. Cold
they
cash
chase money. 64 bits.
Yeah.
they chase 64 bits.
Buttle writes, I was curious about your thoughts on the codename Project Cafe. My thought was that it was like a cafe and that there's something for everyone. It appears to be able to play games from every Nintendo console and be able to use many different controllers. It seems like in this present generation it's becoming more and more clear that certain games work better with certain controllers, and there is no controller that works best for all games. I'd love it if this concept was embraced and that part of the meaning of Project Cafe would be varied control options. So what do you think? Varied controllers, varied games. What's the meaning behind the codename, or can you think of some other meanings?
Well, to be clear, that code name comes from a singular source that has disseminated out.
Yeah, I don't think that's confirmed.
It's
really
not even remotely confirmed.
I only had one root source when I was researching the rumors feature for this one. And everybody else who used the term referenced back to that source or to a source that referenced that source.
The thing is now, though, there's enough stuff coming out that this is all coming from somewhere. Like,
right.
When it was just, like, one random rumor, like, oh, hey, there's a new, you know, Nintendo console coming out. Now, like, you know that people have actually said, hey, wait a minute, something's going on here. And they've talked to this guy who talked to this guy, you know?
I'm just saying, I wouldn't put too much concern
behind
Project
Cafe is one of the less reliable aspects of the rumor mill at this point.
But no one has come out and debunked that, though, either.
Or for that matter, it may be the case that it was never intended for external consumption, the way that some of the previous code names were. You know, what I mean, like you had to hear a lot about Project Reality,
right? Or Nintendo told different code names to different companies to find leaks.
Oh, here's the thing about code names. They're kind of like military code names. Sometimes they're chosen for almost arbitrarily. And they're not meant to tell you anything about what the project really is, because let's cover some of the history of Nintendo codenames. You've got the first one I ever heard of was Project Reality for N64. Really doesn't tell you anything about that system. Not a whole lot of reality in the N64 library. Yeah.
It tells me Nintendo has some stupid namers. That's all it told me.
Well, they went from Project Reality to Dinosaurs Will Fly. So really not a great literal connection there. And then for GameCube was Project Dolphin. Again, not the most evocative.
Aquatic mammals in your gaming system. Bank
so
it.
GBA was Atlantis.
Yeah, keeping the aquatic theme.
Yeah, maybe they got a little theme going. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, DS was Project Nitro.
Which was awful.
Nitro is horrendous, but also has nothing to do with DS.
Yeah, that's totally cryptic.
And then Wii was Revolution, which it's easy to go back and say, oh, the motion controller was such a revolution. I think they just kind of picked something that sounded cool.
I mean, they did sell it a little.
You can't read too much into this. Project Cafe might be total bullshit.
They sold that one a little bit that way, though.
No, that was more. It did remind me a bit more of Project Reality, which obviously was very tenuously linked to what was really going on. But you know, Project Reality was kind of all part of the Dream Team. And so it's like, oh, this is the most realistic graphics ever. We've got Silicon Graphics. We've got this, that.
Silicon Graphics!
It was part of that stuff. And your Revolution was a similar thing. It was they were just trying to imply a concept. And the concept here was it was just going to be something you'd never seen before.
And a very vague
Whether they
concept.
Even knew themselves exactly what that something was at that point, we can't be sure. But it did end up somewhat living up to it. But yeah, I mean, I don't think that, you know, obviously because this hasn't been used in the public domain by Nintendo yet, it's not really meant to infer anything, so it could be just completely random. I wouldn't be given to take much from it. But in terms of the whole point that Buttle, is it Buttle? I assume that's a reference to Brazil. the Terry Gilliam film, raises here about different games, different controllers. I mean, that is the more information that comes out now, it seems like it's going to be very much in that vein that you've got a new controller that's going to have a 6-inch screen in it, but it's also going to be kind of like a classic controller because it'll have two sticks and, you know, the full complement of buttons and all that kind of thing.
Right.
But at the same time, it will support the Wii Remote. You might have a situation where you might have like a co-op game where someone's using a Wii Remote, someone's using the new controller.
And it may support new motion controls that are...
Yeah, maybe a successor to the Wii Remote that complements this touchscreen classic controller as well. So,
which, you know, in the era of wireless controllers, I think having cross-compatibility with a number of different controller formats is much more practical than it was in previous generations.
Well, as long as they don't make us dongle them all up, I think
right,
we're fine.
Right. I tell you what I would give to have a good first-party classic controller for the Wii that doesn't have a wire, that doesn't have a cord, that's just standalone, right, and it has like a little IR camera in the thing so I can use the menu really quick just to get around, but then I can play the game and I'm just holding this nice wireless controller by itself that's not tethered to a damn Wii Remote sitting on the floor.
Use the wheel.
I would love to have that.
Playing Phantom Brave, that really has become an issue.
It's just annoying. It's a minor thing.
It's very minor, but I mean,
it's annoying. It's not really a truly wireless controller when there's a fucking wire hanging off of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was just made the classic controller cheaper.
Yeah.
They pocketed those savings probably mostly.
And they
maybe they passed some on to the consumer as well. That's not too uncharitable. But yeah, I mean, I think that may well be, you know, what we're moving towards here is that there isn't, you know, one way to play all the games that are on this system, which of course has been true on the Wii.
Right.
You know, we've had plenty of games we prefer to play with the classic controller or NES style, you've played them, as well as the Nunchuck and Motion Plus and all. I mean, it's been
the balance board, the zapper, the vitality sensor.
Yeah.
The zapper. Zapper doesn't count.
I guess the thing is maybe here is that they might kind of embrace that more from the outset and, you know, hopefully it will signal a change in philosophy that will never again see the kind of thing that we had with Donkey Kong Country Returns, where we've got this absurd gesture control because they're forcing us to use this one option, and then you get backed into a corner. So, you know, I hope that that's what they're going to do. The only problem that I see with that is just, does it, you know, muddle the message from a marketing point of view in terms of what is this new thing? Why should we buy it?
Right. And does it mean that I have to have 8 controllers for my next system?
8?
Just
yeah,
of the all different varieties, and you know, just do I have to have one of every contingency?
You're not getting off for under 12.
Because I feel like I've already got a lot of controllers.
Oh,
I mean, I'm a triple console owner right now, so I have a fuckload of controllers. They're all over my living room.
I have a whole shelf of just Wii shit.
Yeah.
Then it's like, yeah, step into the Rock Band wing of my hall of controllers, please. Have a look. They're all in there.
The vault.
I haven't even bought the guitar yet.
Oh, I'm just gotta get your Gods of Rock guitar and you'll be good to go. It changes shape, John.
I just think when I hear the Project Cafe name, I have to think that with this whole line of rumors that state that there's going to be some sort of screen in the controller, I have to think that there's going to be some element, especially looking at how the console market in Japan is pretty much just kind of going downhill. Portables really seem to be on the rise.
Are you looking at the VMU concept?
Kind of, yes. Yeah, something like that, but actually done
well,
in a way
I mean, it's connectivity. I mean, in some ways, this might explain why there's been no connectivity between Wii and DS of any meaningful sort, you know, compared to what we saw with Four Swords Adventures, etc.
Dude, Pokemon Battle Revolution.
Oh, come on.
Did you forget it? First online Wii game.
It was the first online. I remember,
but, you know,
when we...
In the gameplay sense, you know, like having things like on your own private screen while everyone plays on the big screen, all that kind of stuff. You know, that was stuff that they were doing on GBA and the GameCube that seemed like it was far better suited for Wii and DS with the wireless and the fact that the DS was hugely successful as well as the Wii. But it didn't happen, and you have to wonder whether that's because they've been working on it in a more integrated fashion for the next console.
Yeah, I just have to think that something tells me that they've looked at Japan and said, you know, games like, you know, Pokemon, Dragon Quest IX, these games are huge in Japan where proximity is important in the way they design things, you know. Maybe not so much in the West because, you know, like not everybody's taking the train. A lot of people, like, you know, people's commute is, you know, driving to work and stuff. But I have to think that there will be some element of this console in which you will be able to take, in some way, the games that you would you play at home, take them on the road with you, and do something meaningful.
It's interesting because I think the reports, the best that we've kind of narrowed it down, the reports so far, is that it will only kind of stream stuff from the console while it's on.
Right. It's
and not
it's,
store. But, I mean, it's an intriguing point that you raise because, I mean, as we've said, as we've noted last week, you know, I mean, the Wii is really dying in Japan.
Yeah.
But far beyond what's happening in America. So that may be a big concern of theirs, is how to kind of capture some of that portable mojo in the console space.
There is quite a bit of ambiguity about the system.
Yeah.
But as it exists, obviously.
Yeah.
But in the specific details referencing the capacities of this apparent, I mean, even though we know quite a bit, we still have to say that the screen itself is still a rumor. The screen
it is.
Controller.
I mean, it's one of the most often repeated ones. I think Kotaku have kind of one-upped everyone by getting a little more specific by saying the screen is 6.2 inches in size.
Right.
Rather
that's
than just
a
six
pretty
inches.
Big screen to slap.
Well, yeah, but if
they've got controls on it too, that's going to be a humongous like Xbox Duke controller.
If you think about it in terms of diagonals, though. Depending on what directions you stretch it, it doesn't have to be that big.
Because that's the point. It's a diagonal line, but if that diagonal line is, you know, sort of an acute angle,
it could be vertical.
Right, that's just narrow.
It could be a tablet that you can hook up to a TV and then also plug a controller into.
Not happening.
You don't think so?
That's not reality.
Nintendo's not going to make their own iPad. That's a losing comparison for them.
No, I mean you got to think about cost, but it may it may be that the screen is not like really, you know, it's not. I strongly doubt it's going to be 6 inches in a 4:3 ratio. Let's put it that way. It's not going to be that big.
So where I was going is that we don't know specific capacities. Obviously, I mean, but assuming what we know about the screen on a controller is true, there is a fair amount of ambiguity in how the download versus streaming stuff works in relation to that controller, which, you know, it may not be a big deal, but we're not going to know what is important until maybe E3, maybe even after that.
It's going to be, I mean, of course, the next date to think about is actually going to be very shortly after this episode goes out, which is the April 26th investors meeting.
Yes.
You know, Iwata will be doing a briefing for the investors. And, I mean, the most pertinent things there is probably going to be, if they're going to talk about a new console, is which fiscal year is it going to come out in, this one that we're currently in or the one after that? So, I mean, if they're going to talk about the new console ahead of E3, that may be the long and the short of it. But they may also, you know, as was Dub Pepper before, maybe cite one key feature of it, you know, dual screens, 3D without glasses, you know, that's the way that the DS and the 3DS were first announced. It's like, well, we're working on this. It's going to come out in this window and this is the one feature of it. So we may get that, but whether or not that's the screen in the controller.
Right. I mean, the 3DS came out because Nintendo realized they had a leak problem. And this time they really found out they have a leak problem.
Yeah, they do. So it would seem.
Which is not the company that we're used to dealing with. Yes. I mean, they've been kind of throwing us surprises lately as a company.
It's the brand new Nintendo.
Leaks were not usually one of their problems.
By the way, before we move on, I think it's worth noting that what John mentioned about this idea of maybe including some kind of portability factor into the controller or into the system, something that you can take with you, very much aligned with what Sony's planning or what they've claimed to be doing with the NGP, which is that you might have PS3 games that you can play on both systems and kind of they'd be cross-compatible. You could sort of play some on at home on your PS3 and then transfer your save to your NGP and take it with you and go play more of it when you're out and about.
But don't they run the risk of poisoning the water a little bit for the 3DS if they make this?
I've thought about that. I think it's going to be really interesting to see if they do go with that, how they differentiate.
I mean, the question is like, what do you do? Like, do you just make things that are kind of subordinate?
Right. Like VMU stuff, like mini games type, almost like iPhone games.
That are ruining the value of games.
But these might be games that you don't necessarily buy a la carte. They would be part of some console game that's downloaded to it that you take with you. But it's maybe there's not actually like a marketplace. It's not like they're selling these things for a dollar. It's that they're selling them for $60 that just happen to be part of the big game.
We need like a big speculation image for the art that go with this particular question.
Yeah.
Stored speculation in big red letters.
Well, the next letter is actually also about the new system.
Yes, sir, I've got this one. This is from Sir Lord Admiral Combo, quote-unquote Manchubs, the 45th of Florida. And I should note that if you have a knighthood, but you also hold a military rank, the military rank goes first.
Well, as usual, the Britons have it backwards because Manchubs is from Florida.
Where you can't legally have a honorary title.
I can't imagine you could. I could see you'd be neither a lord nor a knight. But
there's a constitutional issue with that, but okay.
Greetings, friends. I am called Combo. You may call me Combo. With the rumours surrounding the supposed quote-unquote Super Wii, or Perfect Nintendo Entertainment System, PNES, as I like to call it. See, look, that's where you have to do the... where you can't just spell out the letters. You have to sort of say the acronym, otherwise it doesn't make sense. I thought a discussion on the downloadable scene would be of interest. First off, do you chaps think a virtual console with GameCube games would be at all feasible? If so, to make things interesting, are there any obscure hidden gems you would like to see brought back for everyone to bask in the glory of? I personally would very much like to have the chance to check out Baton Kaitos and Chibi Robo. Secondly, with the recent trend of HD enhanced collections like God of War, Sly Cooper and Team Eco collections, for example, do you think Nintendo would ever release similar HD collections for the PNES? I personally wouldn't mind a disc with Wind Waker, Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword all done up nice and pretty. That'd be all. Keep up the adequate work.
Oh, boy. What? This question made me want to kill myself, so congratulations.
Well, phallic acronyms will do that to you.
Not to John. He was giggling the whole time.
I would say the crux of this question is, does it retain GameCube backwards compatibility to some extent? Because the whole it's PS3
two
thing...
two generations like, back. It's so...
it's two generations back, but the
but
thing is,
really.
It's so close to Wii that if you've got Wii backwards compatibility, which everyone seems... all the reports indicate that it will, how much do you have to try to actually cut GameCube backwards compatibility out?
you have to basically cut the ports out.
Well, and that's the problem, is that a lot of Wii games use the GameCube ports too.
Right.
So if you're going to make it backwards compatible with Wii, you might as well do GameCube, because I don't think there's a whole lot of savings you could get by removing GameCube compatibility.
So here's where I think you're likely to see a difference, though. To give an explanation as to why the GameCube almost feels like a foregone conclusion. The Wii uses an IBM-based CPU and an ATI-based GPU. Apparently, the Wii successor unit is going to use architecture very similar to what Microsoft currently uses in the Xbox, which also happens to be an IBM-based PowerPC CPU and an ATI GPU. So, in theory, they're moving up the chart and jumping over where Microsoft is on the same graph. So the GameCube uses a version even older of the Wii hardware. Mm. So essentially, it's just the same path up. What we're likely to see, though, is because there's such a big difference, we're probably not going to have to trick our Wii successor into thinking it's a GameCube.
Yeah, because when it goes into GameCube mode, it just thinks it's a GameCube. It functions exactly as a GameCube.
Right. There should be enough leftover beef to tell you, no, you're not really a GameCube. Don't worry.
Well, I mean, that's part of, but if you go outside of that, then you're basically emulating it in some way, to some extent.
Yeah.
You might be running some of the processors in a legacy mode, but you still have to emulate the boot up interface and everything. So
right.
That is probably doable. I mean, can you emulate GameCube on Xbox hardware? Almost. And I mean, Xbox emulates Xbox hardware, which is in some ways more powerful than GameCube.
Right.
In some ways not, but...
And keep in mind that the Xbox hardware and the 360 hardware are very different.
Very, very different, yes.
Mm, versus this, which is still somewhat evolutionary all the way back to GameCube era.
It may be, yeah. But I mean, the point is that you didn't see these HD collections, especially the discs, you know, because they put, I think even more so in Europe than in North America, you get discs of, you know, like Splinter Cell, Prince of Persia, Tomb Raider, all the PS2 games collected onto a disc for a series and put out, you know, on a Blu-ray for PS3. And then you get some digital releases as well. But that did not happen until Sony made the decisive break with just like, they started with backwards compatibility, you know, in the hardware, then they kind of had software based, then they just took it out altogether and they gave up, and then they said, screw it. So if Nintendo doesn't have it for whatever reason it may be, that we can't really see at this point, then maybe it'd be more likely that they'll do reissues. But I suppose we should note that Nintendo seemingly has not met a re-release it didn't like.
Sure.
It seems likely that we will get certain targeted, you know, re-releases that will be up-resed or have some, maybe some extra new features.
Much look like at the 3DS. Way we see
3DS, exactly, and Ocarina.
They're not exactly HD, but there's, you know,
they're 3D and they've made throw in a few new features and they clean some things up and whatnot. You know, I mean, it could be very much the same thing. I suppose the interesting part will be how will they approach that from a digital versus physical angle.
I can certainly see them adding GameCube games to Virtual Console on the new system. If, you know, if it's capable of emulating, you pretty much have to emulate at that point, unless you have some kind of weird ROM booter system to run it in GameCube mode. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But I can certainly see them doing Virtual Console sales, because even if the hardware itself is physically compatible with GameCube games, which does seem likely for the reasons that we've described, by putting those games on Virtual Console, it allows Nintendo to actually make money on selling those games again, whereas, you know, they don't make GameCube games anymore. So if you want to go find, it's not actually, I don't think it's that hard to go find a copy of Baten Kaitos or Chibi Robo, and you can certainly play it on your Wii, and you can probably play it on the new system. But if you do that, Nintendo's not making any money on it, because that's a used copy that was sold long ago. Yep. So they would love to put it on Virtual Console, sell them for $15, and actually make money on those old games. But I think, as with Virtual Console, they're going to have a much greater focus on the mainstream surefire hits. And so I don't necessarily think it's going to be a treasure trove of like rare, obscure GameCube titles, which there aren't that many of in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, something like Chibi Robo is not necessarily super obscure, but they did bring it back for New Play Control in Japan. I could see that maybe being in play for a downloadable re-release.
Oh, sure. But I'm just saying their top priority is Mario Sunshine and Wind Waker and stuff like that, Luigi's Mansion.
But on the other hand, I mean, as I said, in certain key cases, they may be like, let's not do that digitally. Let's put Wind Waker and Twilight Princess together in a HD special collection and put that on a disc.
Or let's release them individually on 3DS.
Right. I think they're much more likely to do individual, maybe budget price releases than any kind of, I mean, this bundle scenario of Wind Waker, Twilight Princess, and Skyward Sword. Technically, they did that with Metroid Prime Trilogy, but remember how surprised we all were when they did that? Because they don't do that kind of thing very much.
Well, they also did something pretty similar with Super Mario All-Stars Once Upon a Time, which was a good success for them, you know, just did a graphical, you know, gussied up, as the term goes, and collected a bunch of games together.
Boy, that decision's paid dividends on the Wii.
That's right, because now they put it on a DVD.
So, I mean, they'll put a gift that keeps on giving. I mean, yeah. I just think for certain, you know, it probably would have to be a Mario, Zelda, you know, one of the big boys. Mm-hmm. They might just say, let's not, you know, because in fact, they didn't put Super Mario All-Stars on Virtual Console. They released it as a disc, and I'm sure they're happy with that decision. So yeah. I wouldn't be surprised to see a similar calculus be applied to certain GameCube titles, but probably very isolated cases.
I also have to think that the size of these games will eventually play in as well.
Right.
I mean, when you download gigs worth of games.
Imagine how many times Mario would hit a coin. Ding, 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 ding.
Well, this
ding,
is
ding,
the thing. Then we're verging into the whole issue of, you know, what do they envision for their downloadable platform? You know, what kind of storage are we dealing with? How serious are they really going to be? I mean, it's interesting because what we've seen with WiiWare and DSiWare, and of course we haven't got to the eShop yet to see exactly what that's going to be like, but with WiiWare and DSiWare, you look at the file size limits, and some of that is, I'm sure, you know, because of the technical setup of the whole service and the limitations of the memory. But it also seems to me that they wanted to box those digital offerings into a very specific value area. Yeah. You know, they didn't want them to be obviously $1 like the App Store, because that would destroy the industry. But at the same time,
that's right, it would collapse.
They certainly wanted to have them be very separate from retail products. You know, much less substantial, just by definition, because you know, the data, you just couldn't have the size of these things be that big. So no one would think, well, I enjoyed this. I enjoyed spending 1,000 Wii points on it. But God, you know, it makes these retail games seem like such a ripoff. You know, they wanted to.
It's almost non-competitive by design.
They wanted to keep it in this little box. And the point is, now that, yeah, that was 3 years ago, whatever, with WiiWare.
It makes less sense on a console, especially if it's got a hard drive, which is very likely.
They'll have substantial memory. So, I mean, the question is, 3 years, you know, or by the time it comes out, you're 4 years on from WiiWare or whatever. Where do they see that? You know, do they see digital offerings potentially having a whole different kinds of values? You know, some may be, you know, nearing the cost of retail games, some might be all the way down to a few bucks. You know, that is an unanswered question. You know, when Iwata gets up there at GDC and he says what he says about low price games and all that, he didn't offer an alternative vision.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we don't know how happy they're going to be to have GameCube games on there, you know, which are somewhat, you know, they're not a million miles away.
Well, do you remember the game that forced Microsoft to increase their Xbox Live Arcade file?
Symphony of the Night,
mm-hmm. which is very much a virtual console type scenario. So, you know, it could be a similar motivator here. And we should note, GameCube discs hold up to 1.5 gigabytes, but there are a couple of games that came on multiple discs, but I think actually most GameCube games didn't even use the whole disc. Animal Crossing fit within the 64 megabytes of RAM on the system. You could play it, you could start it with a disc and then take the disc out and keep playing it.
Considering the textures, I mean.
Yeah. So, a lot of GameCube games probably run well under a gig, even big ones, you know, even.
Yeah, I mean, but to put that in context, like quite a few PS3 demos at 2 gigs.
Sure.
But we're also dealing with a company that understands basic networking, although maybe I'm giving Sony a bit of credit this week.
Yeah.
And a company that doesn't understand networks.
They at least try networking.
To be fair, it remains to be seen. That's what I'm saying. You know, and I hope the optimistic thing to take, if you want to take something optimistic about Iwata complaining about the whole ecosystem of digital content on the App Store, etc., is that hopefully, even though they didn't articulate it there, they are forming a coherent, sound, strategic, alternative vision of digital content for their next system in a way that clearly they never really attempted with Wii DS.
The biggest thing anyone has ever downloaded on a Nintendo platform is 40 megabytes. So they've got a lot of room for growth.
But, you know, with the eShop already, you know, we're hearing about the launch title of sorts that's going to be the prologue prototype version of Mega Man Legends 3.
The pay demo.
That's interesting. No, well, that's interesting, though. I mean, straight off the bat, you know, day one, it's not just going to be like the really predictable stuff like Link's Awakening or whatever like that.
Right.
That is... Yeah, for the equivalent of, what is it, like $3 or whatever, 300 yen.
It's 200.
Oh, it's 200? Oh, it's cheaper than I thought.
James, you don't know that it's a demo. It could be, it's not necessarily a subset of the final game. It could be completely different content.
But I mean, I kind of see it maybe, it's a bit like, you know, obviously what Gran Turismo does, you know, with their prologue versions, where they kind of squeeze some money out before the thing's done.
You helped design this game, now help pay for it.
In that case, Gran Turismo is, you know, such a huge series, especially in Europe, that they can do that, you know, basically because they know the fan, you know, there's a dedicated fan base that'll lap it up. Whereas here, it's just like this thing, it really seems like Capcom doesn't want to green light it, but they just have to find all these ways of justifying its existence. And this is another one to try and keep it going. But it'll be an interesting experiment.
It's like the Capcom powers that be lost a bet with the producer who'd wanted to make this game for 10 years.
I think this plan is a wonderful opportunity for promoting that game, because you got to figure on the day the eShop launches, this is going to be one of the most interesting things available. And a lot of people might pay for it and download it, even if they don't really think that they care about Mega Man Legends 3, So this is a really good way to build up some hype and some mindshare for the final game with a very wide audience who might otherwise not really know much about it.
No, I mean, you've got to look at it. I mean, the eShop launch day is almost like launch take two.
And that probably will be my launch day, actually.
And I mean, mm-hmm. James commented, last week or whatever about the fact that there's all those like high profile fighting games coming out right around then and all. And
on the same day.
Well, I think BlazBlue actually went back a week or something.
Because they went, oh shit, what is
going
on?
But still, I mean, I think it's because that people want to be in that slot. They know that, right. that people like Johnny are going to get in at that time. Yeah. And
it's right before Zelda.
Yeah, it's a few weeks before Zelda in the middle of June. Everyone's attention is going to be drawn back to 3DS for a while. And what a great opportunity it is to be on the eShop on day one. I mean, they must be happy with it at Capcom.
Yeah, I think that's a very smart plan. I don't know that the prototype version will be worth whatever they end up charging for it. Who can say right now? But I think as a way to market the full game, it's brilliant. Especially if that game actually comes out soon, you know, like maybe end of the year. So it won't be like a Metroid Prime Hunters scenario where by the time the full game comes
out,
everybody's...
Here's the demo. We'll see it in 3 years.
Yeah, that was poor planning. So... All right, everybody. Well, thank you, everyone who wrote in. We had some really good emails this week. Very creative one from Manchubs there. I appreciate the effort. Of course, you can send in your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would absolutely love to hear from you. Questions, ideas, suggestions, feedback on whatever. We would love to have that, and we will get more emails very soon on the show. You can hit us up in TalkBack. You know, the articles. Actually, I want to throw in a little pitch for the work I do every week on posting these articles. It's nothing compared to what Greg does editing the show. But the articles are a nice resource for our listeners, because if there's any game that sounded interesting to you over the course of the show and maybe you forgot the name of it or you weren't sure exactly which game we were talking about, you can go to the article, and actually all the games that are in our database that we talk about on the show are linked on the sidebar for that article, so you have very quick access to anything that was related that was discussed on the show. And we have like blogs and news articles and stuff like that that's linked there too. So it's a nice way to go find out more information. It's like, you know, further reading. You should go check that out. And of course, from there you can hit the talk back, and there's always a lot of activity in
and
there. And troll us, yeah. And we will respond. We'll defend ourselves, usually.
With vigor.
I'll just change your screen name, change your icon, and possibly ban you. I mean, it depends on my mood.
Don't threaten them.
Any of us can ban, remember that.
These aren't threats. These are actions I've taken.
These are promises.
Credible threats.
I may rename the Funhouse to make fun of you.
Yes, there's also a brand new newscast, and you might hear Nathan Mustafa almost get in a car wreck because he's trying to podcast over his cell phone in L.A. traffic. I enjoyed that segment. Yep. And there's a new Radio Trivia episode 91, and Michael TYP Cole actually has our new Australian correspondent Andrew Brown on the show. And one of the games that they talk about actually is one that I want to highlight, because although you might think it's a crappy game, the music is amazing, and that would be Castlevania for the N64. Really, I know you're thinking, man, that game sucks. Everybody says it sucks. The music is incredible. You want to hear it. You really do. And finally, just a little plug, something I do on the side. It's a podcast called Discover Music Project. We just had a couple episodes with Andy Gergen from the newscast, where we talked about the Decemberists and Damien Rice. And the next one's going up. I recorded a couple of really fun episodes with our former staff member, Grant Buell, where we talk about Pink Floyd and the Flaming Lips. So you really should go check that out. Look it up on iTunes, or head over to crosstalk.com for more information. Thanks for listening. We'll be back.
Hang on.
Uh-oh.
No, next week I won't be here recording the show. I would like to tell you that I am going to be missing the show because of some sort of overblown preparations to celebrate the royal wedding to burnish my patriotic credentials. I can't stress that word enough, patriotic. But, in fact, I may be doing the one thing that could be described as diametrically opposed to that, which is staying up to watch the NFL draft. So, you may be thinking, oh, aren't the Bills awful all the time? What's so different about this year? Well, in fact, they're drafting third, which is the highest they've drafted in 26 years, which is pretty much equivalent to my lifetime.
It's very hard to get in that top 4. I mean, you have to be historically terrible.
So, if there's a decent chance that we may take one of the Auburn Tigers in this year's draft, in which case I will hold our own Auburn Tiger, Johnny Metz, responsible for how they turn out.
Yes. Singularly responsible.
Not, of course, the coaches and the GM.
I trained them myself. Cam and Nick. Yeah, those are my boys. They owe everything to me.
Where's your laptop, Johnny?
I'm looking at it.
Just for the record, the last time the Bills drafted higher in 1985, first overall, they took Bruce Smith, the all-time sack leader. So if it turns out that well this time, I'll be pretty fucking happy. But this historic occasion will bring an end to my streak on numbered episodes. So obviously I've missed E3 and PAX East and all that sort of thing. But in terms of numbered episodes, I have been on every one since episode 173 back in December 2009. This was called Pokemon Uranium. Listeners might remember it actually for having the Chris Kohler Retro Gaming Collection feature where he talked about the Vectrex and all that sort of thing, which is good.
The one
fun
that he just repeated at PAX East a few months later. Yes.
Yeah, well, it's good content. It's good content. And if you were with us, you got in on the ground floor.
Right.
But also in this episode was a discussion, hence the name, of the future of the Pokemon series and also the future of Nintendo's console and portable hardware. And so I just wanted to recount some of the things.
Oh, no.
Just to give people the sense of how long ago this was and the fact that I've been on every numbered episode since. So, since this discussion, 7 Pokemon games have been released around the world.
Shit.
Heart Gold, Soul Silver, Poképark Wii, Pikachu's Adventure, Pokemon Ranger, Guardian Signs, Pokemon Black, Pokemon White, and the recently released in Japan, Pokemon Battle and Get Typing DS.
Yes!
Nice.
Of course, also in that time, the 3DS was first announced, revealed, and then launched. We may well have a new console announcement if it happens at the investors meeting before I actually miss next week's episode. And also, just more broadly, Britain had a change of prime minister. The US House of Representatives changed from the Democrats to the Republicans. The Bills got a new head coach. The site got a new director, Neil Ronahan. Johnny became a doctor. John moved to Boston. I missed PAX East twice. Brett Favre retired twice. Retronauts died and came back to life. Guitar Hero just died. And John still hasn't finished Chrono Trigger.
Bravo. You are the Cal Ripken Jr. of podcasts.
Yes. You're the Brett Favre of podcasts to me now.
My crown passes to James, who has been on every episode since 218. So it's a bit of a step back, unfortunately, in the Iron Man stakes, but I have faith in James to carry it forward.
Hey, you know, we're only 10 episodes away from the big 250, 5 years of Radio Free Nintendo.
Oh, boy.
That's crazy.
We got to figure out what we're going to do.
It's got to be Wii-related, considering the genesis of the podcast.
Well,
if
you missed it last summer, on episode 200, we did a big look back at the DS, which is very timely now that, you know, we're counting down our favorite 30 DS games and the 3DS is out. So if you missed that, you should go back and listen to 200 and 150 and 152. They're all those milestone shows are really good. But 5 years, half a decade of Radio Free Nintendo. That's over a sixth of my lifetime. Hey, it's time to end this one so we can get working on the next one. So we're going to end it. Thank you for listening and check us out next week.
Later.
See ya.
Bye-bye.